Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective is presented by YouTube TV. Try it free today at youtube.com/NBA23. New users only. Terms apply. Cancel anytime. Hello, welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we are doing on Friday afternoon. Joining me from New York City is Tim Bonteps.
Hello, fellas.
And joining me from a few miles down the road, I can't be bothered to stay in the same place he is. I don't want to run into him in the lobby, is Ben McMahon.
Howdy, partners. Wendy, you are one hell of a teammate.
I actually need McMahon to give me a microphone because at 5:59 this morning, my microphone I was using in my hotel room to do TV. That's what we do at the Big Bad ESPN. We do TV in our hotel rooms. Failed. And so I need, you know, McMahon's not working, so I can borrow his microphone.
Oh, the shade.
Anyway, joining us from Westport, Connecticut, we're so happy to have him to talk ahead of game two of the NBA Finals. Former Milwaukee Bucks owner, NBA champion. In fact, if you are watching on YouTube, you can see his replica Larry O'Brien trophy strategically placed over his shoulder is Mark Lazary. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
I'm sure when you see, do you have FOMO when you see the finals?
No, I mean, I think if we were in the finals, I'd have FOMO. that would be different. I think when you're not, you just watch the games and you enjoy it.
I'm guessing you didn't have any FOMO in the first round.
that was a bit of a surprise, I would tell you. So no, I was very surprised at what happened.
Well, what you were at that game five, I saw you there as I was. What was it like watching that game five courtside as it was unfolding?
You know, you were surprised at what was happening because I think the Bucks were up by 14. Everything looked really good. Then all of a sudden, everything just fell apart. And I think we needed to do was score a few baskets, and that didn't happen. And then all you saw was Jimmy screaming and yelling and telling everybody he was going to score. And then doing it. Yeah, and then doing it, which was not what you were expecting. And then on the last play, you know, when he pushed off Pat so he could score that layup, which was a phenomenal pass and a phenomenal basket, it just didn't feel good going into overtime. And then we sort of saw what happened. So I was pretty surprised about it.
Yeah, that was a tough one. But just a reminder of how special it is when you win, quite frankly, because the alignment that needs to happen to win a title is so amazing. And this team was, I don't know. I mean, I would argue this was better than the 2021 team. Maybe you would disagree. I don't know. But you guys were loaded for bear for this season. You had the number one seed in a year where the East was as good as it's been in 20 years. And some things didn't go your way in your home in April.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think what you find out about basketball, and this team was just deeper and stronger, and it couldn't have gone better that you're the number one seed, you're playing the number eight seed, right? So you're assuming you're going to win. Even when we were down, when you lose the first game, you still think you're going to win. Even with Giannis hurt, you thought you would win. And it's just surprising what happens, and it's what makes basketball so great, or any sport so great, is that the unimaginable seems to happen more often than not.
I know.
And we're always surprised at it, but it happens. Look, you got to tip your hat off. I mean, you know, Jimmy Butler played phenomenal, but it always seems like in every series that somebody is playing great. And if you're not playing well, I mean, you saw it in the Celtics series, they couldn't even hit a three. You know, here's a team that was just scoring threes everywhere, and all of a sudden they're shooting 20%, 25%. So you never want to go through a cold spell when you're going through a series. I mean, it's a nightmare. And I think you find that, and when that happens, you end up losing.
Well, I can tell you the Heat were shell-shocked a week ago when Derek White hit that putback. I mean, that building was absolutely ready for a party, and you know, just on a Saturday night in Miami, and it just savaged. I mean, that's the NBA. Like, you know, and seeing the players, and you know, when you cover a series, and like, you know, you're deeply involved, you know, when you're in the ownership, going through a series like that. And I can remember this last year, Mark, in your series with the Celtics, that seven-game series, the highs and lows in that series, the times where the Celtics thought they were wrong, the times where you guys wrote, you know, game five, you rise up and win in Boston. And the highs and lows of a series are so intense, which is why, you know, the two-month run is such an accomplishment, and why I will never, one of the things I just don't stand for is when anybody tries to disregard a title. Well, so-and-so got hurt. Mm-hmm. Asterisk here, asterisk there. Absolutely unacceptable in my mind as somebody who's been up close and watched what these teams go through. And, you know, you've been on the front line of that.
Look, I totally agree with you. It's the highs and lows are tremendous. I mean, last year we're up 3-2. You go to Milwaukee, you're up 10 points going into the fourth. And every time, you know, Tatum scoring a basket or somebody scoring a basket, I mean, you're screaming. You can't believe it. And you get so emotional. I mean, I'm screaming at guys. I'm like, just cover them. You know, I'll scream at the coach, cover Tatum, do this, do that. You get so emotional because you're so invested. And you know, a lot of it is just a matter of luck. I mean, that is somebody getting hot and somebody getting cold. And you think you're in the best position. You're up 3-2 in your home and you're up 10 points going into the fourth. What could be better? And then you lose the next two games.
Well, and you mentioned luck, Mark. What stands out to you? Is the game seven in Brooklyn the game that stands out to you the most outside of, I guess, probably game six from the title run? And if so, what do you remember about sitting there and watching that game at Barclays that night?
You know, I remember thinking, all right, we've got this. And then Brooke somehow manages to get we don't even get a shot off. So now Brooke, you know, thought we were going to end up at least scoring. We don't do anything. Then Durant's got the ball and you see that he's getting ready to shoot and he shoots. And I was sitting with my son and I actually couldn't look to see if he made it. Because you know, if he makes it, you're out. Right. So I figured, okay, I'm going to look to the side and the fans will tell me what happened. Because if everybody screams, that means he made it. And if everybody goes, you know, I'd be the only one jumping up and down. Right. And then you hear everybody go crazy. And I'm like, did that go in? You look and he's standing behind the 3-point line. So I thought we lost. Mm-hmm. And my son said, no. I think his foot was on the line. I'm like, are you sure? He goes, yeah. And then so now life comes back into you. But you know, if you remember, I think the overtime, we won 4-2. I mean, we scored two baskets.
Nobody scored forever. Yeah. Nobody scored forever. And then Giannis made that. He came down and made that runner. I think him and Middleton each had one bucket.
Like, think about that. It was 4-2 in a 5-minute overtime because everybody was absolutely exhausted. You know, it's exactly what you say. I mean, you just live every basket. I was sitting next to Joe Tsai in one of the games. And every time we'd score, I'd scream, yes. And I'd look at Joe and go, so sorry.
Yeah, that's such an odd, dynamic because the owners are, it's very much of a, from what I see, I'm not in the room. It's very much of a fraternity. You know, you guys are truly partners. I know that there are times you butt heads and sometimes you sue each other, et cetera, but.
Who doesn't amongst
friends? Details, who doesn't? It's just friends.
But that's kind of, you know, and he's hosting you at his arena, right? He's like, please come sit with me at my arena.
No, and that's what it is, because you're sitting together. You know, and look, right before the game, and you say this to everybody, like, you know, I always say, look, good luck. I hope we crush you. It's nothing personal, but best of luck. And you know, I don't really mean it. But you're friendly with everybody. And actually what you really want is just a really good game. Right. You actually want a really good game because that's more fun. You feel bad for about a second that your friend has lost. And then you're just thrilled that you won. But you hit it on the head because that's exactly what it is. Because you're not buying tickets. The opposing team is giving you tickets out of a matter of courtesy because they're your partner in the league.
Yeah, that's a whole thing about where the owners sit. Sometimes they have good seats and sometimes they have okay
seats. Not as good. Not as good seats.
But somehow, Mark, you always ended up on the front row. Every time I was ever at a game that you were at, you were always in the front row.
I'm friendly with a lot of the owners. So I think it was always very nice. But yeah, I've seen other owners get stuck in different places because they're not as friendly with somebody.
Or so, you can be like Cuban and just sit right behind the bench as part of the coaching staff.
Yeah, that's lovely. He gets away with it.
Mark would just coach from across the court. He would just scream at the coaches from the other side.
So I remember talking to you about this when you won in 2021, John Horst, your GM, Peter Fagan, your team president. You know, I would have this conversation with a lot of people. I felt like the title that you guys won was truly the most pure way to win because it was an organic title. Yep. And that you guys built the whole thing from the grassroots right up, drafted the guys, developed the guys. You did make a couple of free agent signings, but, and again, you know, I don't denigrate titles, but there's a feeling that it's just deeper when you develop your own title. I remember talking to Chauncey Billups about this when Chauncey was considering taking the Cavs president's job, and he ended up not taking it. And I said, well, you know, Chauncey, I think LeBron is going to leave in a year. He was talking to me about whether he was going to take the job. And he goes, that's okay, because Ty Lue, he was very close to Ty Lue. He says, Ty and I have always talked about wanting to win a title, building it from scratch.
Yeah.
And here's two guys with rings. You know, Ty's got rings. Right. Ty had already won a ring as a coach. Chauncey's got rings. And that's why this Denver Nuggets team that is maybe on the verge of doing it, I see a lot of similarities. Mm. Jokic and Giannis were guys that were talented, but certainly not regarded as these types of players, developed into MVPs. Other guys that were, you know, Chris Middleton, you guys traded for, but really he was a second round pick, like in his second year. Like you guys, the Bucks developed him.
Oh, we did.
Then like the Aaron Gordon trade, Jrue Holiday is a higher profile player, but similar kind of, we're going to bring in this guy who can defend, and strategic free agent signings. Like you guys, Bobby Portis and Brooke Lopez, they bring in Bruce Brown. If the Nuggets win this, it would be an organic raise up. And I just respected you guys' victory so much. And I respect the way the Nuggets have constructed their team as well.
I think you actually have a great point, because what ends up happening is there becomes a love affair within the city because of those players. Right. And you see that. I think everybody in Denver loves the Joker. I think everybody in Milwaukee loves Giannis because he's been there from the very beginning. And Jokic has been there from the very beginning. You know, Chris, he came a year after he was in the league. So he's been there from the very beginning. And I think for us, we sort of felt we built it and it's organic. But the hard part, and we've talked about this, it's really, really hard to do in a small city. Mm-hmm. It just is, right? I mean, it's just because if you're not doing organic, it's really hard to get a big name free agent to decide they're going to come to Milwaukee. It is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for us, and you and I had talked about this, getting Giannis to stay was huge, right? Because they've got so many opportunities to go elsewhere. And I think Jokic, same thing, he had no interest in going. And I think part of that is you sort of feel you're growing up in that city. You love it. You've formed relationships. And then there becomes this desire to try to win for the city and try to do things that other people have not done. And I think you're seeing that more and more with players. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing in Denver. And if they're able to do that, I mean, that'll also be pretty unique.
You know, and the Joker Giannis storyline is extremely similar to the point of back-to-back MVPs, which kind of puts a guy on a pedestal where it's back-to-back MVPs, but you know, he's never been to the finals, you know, and it's almost like it invites more scrutiny. It invites more criticism. And then, you know, the next year, don't get the MVP. Giannis obviously goes on the championship run. Joker's three wins away. But, you know, it was that Jrue Holiday trade for you guys that hushed all the, hey, is Giannis going to stay stuff? You get Jrue Holiday, boom, Giannis is signing that extension, and then off you go. How would you describe, I don't know if pressure is the right word or just a sense of urgency, when you know, hey, we've developed this guy who is absolutely good enough to be, the heart and soul of a championship team. And just how do we figure out how to put the finishing pieces around him to make that a reality?
You know, it's a great question. I would say to you, I don't know if it's a sense of urgency. I think it's definitely pressure. You feel that you have a generational player. I mean, Dallas has that, right? In Luka. Mm-hmm. And you know,
it's almost like someone's writing a book about this. Almost like someone's doing that. I know you listen to the pods. So I know you're aware.
I do. No, that's what I said. I think I know you know this. You feel that there's a partnership with your best player. There should be, right? And the quid pro quo is, look, we want you to stay, and we're going to do everything we can to try to win. And as long as people believe that, then it's a real partnership, mm-hmm. right? What ends up stopping is if all of a sudden Giannis believes we're no longer going to do what it takes to win, then he's going to then do what he thinks is best for him. Right now, what he's going to do is what's best for the city, what's best for the team, because he feels there's a partnership, right? And I think if both parties are trying to do that, then it's okay. And that's, look, the reason we did the Jrue Holiday trade is we sort of felt, and the problem is every team feels this. You always feel you're one player away. Mm-hmm. You always feel like I just need one more player and that'll get me over the hump. And that's okay as long as you keep trying, right? Because it is a chemistry issue. Jrue turned out to be phenomenal. I do think that was the missing piece, right? And then we were able to get, you know, PJ at the trade deadline, mm-hmm. and he turned out to be great, and he was a character, and he is a character.
Oh, yes.
But I think John Horst realized we needed to do certain things, and John and Giannis have a great relationship, and I would say I'm pretty close to Giannis, that you are going to tend to do what's best to try to win. And as long as your star player believes you're doing everything, he's going to keep on staying. It's when all of a sudden that stops. Mm-hmm. And the problem ends up being, you know, that either you're not spending the money or you're not giving up assets, right? And Brian, you were there with Cleveland with LeBron. I mean, you know, for LeBron to stay, it was they were giving up assets every year to make sure they won that year. So you're not trying to build for the future. You're saying, I got to win now. Mm-hmm. And you know you do, because if Giannis isn't there, it's hard to win, right? If LeBron wasn't there, it's hard to win. If Luka's not there, it's going to be hard to win. So you need to keep doing it.
But you did it. You raised the banner. Like, that's the thing. Like, no matter what happens, that banner stays up there. The night in Milwaukee where there was tens of thousands of people outside your arena, and that moment, that will be an iconic moment for the history of Milwaukee. Like, I even told you, like, when you sold the team, I, you know, I'm sure it was bittersweet for you.
It was,
but you'll never, as you could win a couple more titles, you'll never have that moment again, like you had. And the same, cause I experienced it in Cleveland. And to a lesser extent, I also felt that when we were covering the Raptors,
yeah,
you know, the Raptors winning that championship for Toronto, those moments, those titles, you know, and especially in a city that hasn't had that before,
stays with you.
No. So it's like, you know, Cleveland was in a hole for 4 years after LeBron left, but it was worth it.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
I mean, you make the deal and you make it worth it. And you mentioned PJ. I think one of my favorite moments from the playoffs in the last 10 years involved PJ in that series with the Nets, when PJ is just absolutely going to war with Durant. And we see that shot. You didn't see this because you were at the game, but there's this shot, Mark, I'm sure you've seen it since, but where Wanda, Kevin Durant's mother, is screaming at PJ. This is not football. She's frustrated because he's roughing up her son. He's just doing everything he can.
And they've known each other forever, going back to, you know, the Texas ties and all
for
that.
Sure.
Right. And so PJ looks at her and says, I love you. And she says, I love you too. that's the NBA playoffs. That's the NBA playoffs right there. All out war. And sometimes you love him, sometimes you don't, but that's the NBA playoffs. And that's the stuff that we live for.
I'll give you a great story. I think by the fourth game, you know, after we had tied it, I go to Bud and I'm like, Bud, listen, I know you don't want to hear this, but I know PJ is covering Durant. Durant's still scoring 30 or 40 points a game, right? Do you think he's doing a good job? He's scoring like 30, 40. You think maybe we should switch it up? He goes, no. He's doing a great job on him. He's going to score 40. Difference is, with PJ on him, he's going to be exhausted for the last 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
He's not going to be able to do anything. I'm like, okay, you're the coach, but he's still scoring 30, 40 points. And he was right, because you know, PJ, I think, just made it so difficult for him that Durant was exhausted by the end of the series.
What'd you say the overtime score was?
Yeah, 42.
Right.
Yeah, and that's what he's, you know, everybody always says, oh, if Durant had, you know, been an inch back, you know, the Nets win the title. And Durant said, not so fast. I was gassed. How do you think we're going to get through the next two series?
Yeah, which is hilarious because Durant, while he's playing 44, 45 minutes per game with the Suns in these playoffs, is like, why is everybody talking about fatigue? I don't, you know, I'm fine. I can play. You know, it's like, okay, we'll ask you next season when you're honest about it.
Yeah, it was hard.
Well, you mentioned Bud there, Mark, and you had two sort of interesting coaching decisions, I would say, during your time in Milwaukee.
Yep.
One was about a month after you bought the team, you decided to go after your old pal Jason Kidd, which was a nice benefit to me. So thank you for that. And the other was you decided not to fire Mike Budenholzer after the bubble. So I was curious on the first one, did you realize you were going to cause as much of a storm as you did when you went after Jason the first time? And sort of if you could walk us through that process. And then secondly, what went into the decision to stick with Mike? Because as we've seen this summer, including with Mike, there's a lot of teams who have decided to go the other way with really good coaches after disappointing playoff runs like the one you guys had there.
I think the first one with Jason, I had known Jason as a player. I knew him. I had owned a piece of the Nets. So I knew Jason when he played there, and we'd just become very good friends. And I thought he would bring a lot of credibility to Milwaukee, that you had a Hall of Fame guard coming in, Hall of Fame player. He's a great guy. And I thought he'd be a really good coach. He could teach the younger guys. He was great. I mean, the problem with Jason is he demands a lot. He really does. He doesn't understand why people can't do the things that he does, right? And I think that's kind of hard. And I think after 4 years, I think it was time for us to make a change. What I was shocked at is when we brought Jason in, you know, we have this big press conference because everybody thought we did something that was wrong. It's on ESPN.
Well, it was kind of a big deal to poach another team's coach. It was kind of a notable thing. As I said, I appreciated you doing it at the time. It was helpful to me.
Well, no, but the part that was funny is I didn't know the rules. And what I mean by that, I didn't know that when you're going to fire somebody, you're supposed to let them know, hey, just in case, I'd want to let you know it may not work out. And by the way, we're going to try to hire somebody else. But if it doesn't work, by the way, you're my guy. You know, I still love you. We don't, like, you know, in my business, when you are trying to hire somebody, you don't tell the guy you're going to fire, hey, if it doesn't work, you're still going to be here. But I guess in the NBA, you're not supposed to do that. So you're supposed to let people know in advance that you're trying to replace them, even if it doesn't work out. So yeah, it became this huge story. And I found it, I found that a bit surprising. And I said, okay, going forward, we won't do that. With Bud, I thought the bubble was, it was just weird. I mean, I thought it was great that we played, but I thought being in the bubble, it was just weird. And Giannis got hurt. I didn't blame Bud for that. I think there was a lot of stuff going on and we thought we had a really good team and it'd be fine, right? We really did. But I think we were willing to put, you know, to wait and keep on developing. I think today, and you see it, it's exactly what you said, the pressure on everybody to win right now is so great. And if you're favored to win and you don't win, look, somebody's at fault. It's either the GM, it's either the coach, or it's the players, right? It's never the owner.
I was going to say, never the owner.
It's never the owner screwed up. But so it's going to be somebody's going to get in trouble for that. And I think,
unless the owner's the GM, which happens sometimes.
Sometimes. So what you've got to do is if you're the owner, you've got to be patient and you've got to sort of believe. And I think we believe, hey, that wasn't Bud's fault, us losing. It wasn't the player's fault. I thought it was more the situation of where we were. And, you know, I think that turned out to be the right decision at the time.
Well, it's sort of along the lines of patience. When you bought the team in 2014, I looked it up to check. Giannis had played, I think, 77 games. He scored 6.8 points per game. He was obviously an interesting young player, but I don't think anybody necessarily thought he was going to turn into what he's turned into. And you've basically been with him every step of the way. So what has it been like for you to, A, get to know him over time, and B, to see the way he has developed into the player he has over the past 9 years?
You know, when I first met Giannis, we were doing our due diligence on the Bucks. we end up going to have dinner at the practice facility. And there's just one person there shooting baskets. And it was Giannis. I mean, there was nobody else. And it's like 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night. And I remember I asked at the time, John Hammond, who is that? And he goes, oh, it's, you know, it's Giannis. We ended up drafting him. He could turn out to be good, right? Because it's exactly what you said. He was a skinny little guy. Mm-hmm. And it's not, he wasn't scoring that much. And I was like, wow, he seemed, and you know, John's views were very simple. He goes, he's got a great motor and he will work harder than anybody here. And he just loves to play. And I remember I went up to him, said, hi, we're thinking of buying the team, started shooting some baskets with him. You know, we're playing a little game of horse and he decides to jam the ball and say, can you do that? I was like, no. I can't even hit the net. So you automatically win. So it's not even a game. And he's just a sweet kid. And Giannis has continued to be that person. I mean, he really has. He loves the game. He loves people. I'm annoying. Every time I go to a game, I bring 13 people, you know, go on the plane, bring people in. I bring them in the locker room before the game. I bring them after the game. And every time I bring little kids in, I'd always say to Giannis, can you take a picture? The nicest person, happy to take a picture. So is Chris Middleton, Drew Holiday. Everybody's always happy. I remember once, you know, Giannis was sitting, his feet are in an ice bucket. And the kid says to him, he's like a 10-year-old. He goes, oh, do you mind standing up? I'd like to have a picture of the two of us standing up. And Giannis goes, I'm naked. I can't stand up. You know, he's got his little towel around him. And the kid goes, oh, okay, sorry. You got to remember, you're a 10-year-old kid. You're just excited to be in the locker room and you're just taking pictures. And for someone as big as he is, to be as nice as he is, he hasn't really changed. Right? The demands on his time are huge. And he's changed a little, but you expect that. But I can bring people in the locker room. He couldn't be nicer to people. Right. And I would say all our players are like that. I think one of the great things about the Bucks players is they're just nice. They're nice guys. I'm not saying I'm not annoying when I come in there and I ask everybody to take a picture with. But, you know, for everybody else, it's a once in a lifetime experience. It just is. Like, you know, you guys get to see them every day. Somebody comes in, sits courtside, goes in the locker room, and you're seeing their hero. Will go in, they're working out. It's been a cool experience. That's what you said, Brian. It's a bit bittersweet.
And might surprise you. NBA players aren't always nice to us.
If you bring a kid, they better be.
Yeah, you know, last night I was there with the Nuggets family after the game. And, you know, I think the Nuggets, because they've kind of grown up all together like the Bucks, you know, the Nuggets family, they all have, I mean, all the players, you know, you go through the NBA, it's not like the families are at war, but, you know, the camaraderie you can tell with the Nuggets family and, you know, the Jokic brothers are walking around and, you know, everybody's got their family there. And you can, I just feel a lot of Bucks vibes being around the Nuggets. And, you know, I could see them playing in a finals. It could have been this year's finals. This could have been a Denver Milwaukee final. I could see it happening, you know, in the future. And with the league, you know, with these new rules changing over, where I do think it's going to potentially favor more parity, which I don't know, there's a debate about whether or not the rules favor mid markets or not, but you know, it does favor more parity. We could see more mid-market finals in theory.
Well, Mark was on the labor committee. We should ask him, does it favor mid or small markets or not? What's the verdict now that you're not in it anymore?
I think it favors parity, and parity ends up being beneficial to smaller teams,
mm-hmm.
right? If you just think of it that way, the problem, if you're a small market team, is that people are going to want to play in New York, LA, Miami, you know, Dallas, any of the big cities. And so going forward, that's going to be harder to do because of the tax aprons and just the way things are. So that I think you'll have more parity, and it's going to be much more about, you know, which is your point, Brian, is it homegrown talent? Because if you can end up getting a generational player through the draft, all you have to do is bring in one more person and you'll be able to do that. And I don't think like an LA team can bring in three people, right? The cost is just going to be too high. I think that's what everybody, wants, right? All everybody wants is competition, because the more competition there is, the more every team, the beginning of the season, the more anybody, all the teams can say, hey, we have a shot to win a championship, the better it is for the league. You know, it's just because then everybody's got hope, and there's nothing like hope.
That's true. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
No, I really appreciate it. Thank you
and,
very much.
I hope you enjoy the finals as a neutral party.
No, I do. You know what's fun about it now? You can record it, and then you just go right through the commercials and you're zipping through everything.
Please do not go through the commercials on ABC.
I would never do it on ABC. I would always watch the full commercials on ABC.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for your time. Good luck. We'll see you down the line.
I'll see you soon.
I know you'll still be involved in the NBA one way or another going forward.
I know I will. So. I'll come back. You know, I'll be like, who was it? Arnold? I'll be back, right?
Yeah, we all heard what you sold the team for. We know you'll be back.
I'll be back. I'll see you later. Take care.
Right, take care.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, but nothing on your roof. So who's ever up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, girl-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. All right, it's time for trivia, which is presented by YouTube TV. Try it free today at youtube.com/NBA23. New users only. Terms apply. Cancel anytime. Bontemps, your trivia performance in the last pod was shaky at best. It was worse on the re-listen, but we're going to move on because we all make mistakes. And that's
Max
life.
Truce goes 0 for 10, and that's about how Bontemps performed last pod.
Just like Mark Lazary said about the 2020 bubble, he didn't blame Bud, and he stuck with him, so we're going to stick with our
just
guy.
Just the same. Wish I had the same paycheck as Bud. That'd be great.
This is true.
And now, to present today's trivia question, the whiz of the quiz, Tim Bontemps.
So Doc Rivers, we're going to talk about this a little bit later. Doc Rivers did not get the Phoenix Suns job. Does not seem like, I mean, I guess we'll see what happens to Toronto, but seems unlikely he's going to coach a team this year, which would end his streak of consecutive seasons coached at 24.
Wow.
That is second all time in the history of the NBA. I'm pretty sure you guys can get the number one guy on the list in terms of consecutive seasons coached. No, it's not Jerry Sloan. So the question was going to be who makes up the rest of the top five. Jerry Sloan was third.
Pop
is first.
Oh, Pop obviously. Pop passed
27 consecutive years. Doc is at 24. Jerry Sloan is at 23. He is third.
Wow. I felt like Sloan was like 31. I was obviously wrong. Okay.
Felt like 31. So then there's two coaches round out.
Was it?
Red Auerbach was fifth.
Okay.
20. He was tied with Gene Shue, but Red Auerbach was fifth.
Okay. So we're missing the fourth.
Missing fourth. Guy coached the Blazers and Sixers.
Wow. Blazers and Sixers.
Jack Ramsey.
Dr. Jack.
Dr. Jack. I was going to say we know his son if we didn't get farther than that.
Yeah. I should have got that. Oh, man. Dr. Jack. What a powerhouse.
We just had a long conversation with him about him the other day at
I was going to see if he had one with Bash. Him. I'd really like to hear about that.
We were talking about with Dave Pashin, about Hubie the other day.
That's right. So, you know, a few years ago, shortly after Dr. Jack passed, was our colleague at ESPN.
His son was our boss.
That's right. His son, Chris, was our boss. He hired me at ESPN.
He also did some things to really help the company, too.
I was like, I don't think he claims you, McMahon.
No.
But I just remember when we had the sort of his memorial shortly after he died, Hubie spoke. It was during the finals. And we sort of had like a, he had died several months before, but we sort of had like a memorial and Hubie telling Dr. Jack stories. I mean, I wish that had been on tape because, man, just amazing. Speaking of coaching hirings, the Suns made a hire and hired Frank Vogel, according to Woj. You know, when you fire a coach like Monty Williams, who's been successful, you're really under the pressure to make a hire there that you really think has a good chance of moving you forward. And so while I know Kevin Young, mm-hmm. who was their lead assistant and was a strong candidate for the job, and I have heard nothing but good things about both in Phoenix, outside of Phoenix, other organizations.
I know him from Philly. He's a really bright guy.
I suspect he is going to get a head coaching job in the short-term future. But that is a big ask to put that on his shoulders. Not only, you know, on the front office shoulders, that's a big ask to put on his shoulders. You have Booker and Durant. And by the way, I know Devin Booker is a big believer.
Huge believer.
Kevin Young. And so it's a big ask to put him in that situation. So going with Frank Vogel, who has got a lot of experience, has a ring, has long experience of advancing deep in the playoffs. It's a guy that I respect a lot. I've covered a lot over the years. It's a safer hire for what they're trying to do. And you can tell the Suns were twisting on this. You know, you can tell, you can feel it without knowing all the machinations of the back and forth. You can feel that they were seriously considering Doc. You know, I just know, like, as of like yesterday, I was talking to somebody who was talking to somebody in the Suns organization, and the Suns were doing, you know, due diligence on Doc and Frank Vogel. Not that there's much new, I mean, pretty much know who Doc is at this point, but, you know, like, they were seriously looking at it. And I think because they know that this is such an important hire, and, you know, McMahon, you were with them in the playoffs and they got eliminated. Like, they don't have time to mess around. It's high pressure situation. And that's what Vogel stepped into in LA, and it worked. And So I think they're hoping for the same thing.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's a high pressure situation where, you know, they feel like they are right in the middle of a championship window. And obviously when you make the deal that they made for Kevin Durant, it does become a championship or bust type of situation. But it's challenging because that roster is awfully thin.
Ding, ding, ding.
You know, certainly, you know, it's been well chronicled, the headbutting between DeAndre Ayton and Monty Williams, but by no stretch do I believe that Monty Williams' departure makes it much more likely for DeAndre Ayton to still be in Phoenix next season. I still am pretty sure DeAndre Ayton will be traded this summer. You know, they've got a decision to make on Chris Paul. I think that one is certainly more likely for Chris Paul to be back, but they need to understand, you know, what their potential options are there as well. You know, obviously Chris Paul is still a very good player, but at 38 years old, if they could somehow turn him into a couple of quality role players, I think that'd be something that they would have to seriously consider. But you know, you've got two superstars and a lot of question marks around them. But all those question marks, that doesn't diminish the expectations that Frank Vogel's walking into. And the relationship he is able to develop with Devin Booker is obviously going to be critical. And I'll be honest with you, I thought Kevin Young was going to get this job because I know that Devin Booker is, you know, a huge, huge fan of his. And again, it's not just that he likes him, it's that he respects him and he believes in him. So I think it became a deal where, you know, Ishbia and the people he's listened to just didn't feel like with a team in this situation that they could go with a rookie NBA head coach.
Yeah, I mean, look, I echo your sentiments on Kevin Young. I think he's a bright guy. I think he's going to be a head coach. He's probably going to be a good head coach. I can understand why the Suns wanted to go with a veteran guy who's won a title, who's had a ton of success. Frank Vogel's a really good guy. I suspect he'll be able to have good relationships with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker. I don't think that'll be an issue. I think it goes back to what you talked about. We're going to get to the game one of the finals and looking at game two in a little bit here, but the Phoenix Suns were not good enough in the second round to beat Denver. And the two games they won required Kevin Durant and Devin Booker to do absolutely historic things offensively, and they barely won both games. And I don't really care what Frank Vogel does with their defense. They have to find ways to upgrade this roster this summer when they're not going to have access to the tax MLE, probably, if they get up that high. They have to figure out what they're doing with DeAndre Ayton. They have to figure out what they're doing with Chris Paul. And they have to find ways to add talent to this roster with no trade assets, really. So it's going to be a very challenging line to walk there to get enough talent on this roster to make it good enough to compete with Denver and these other elite teams in the West. Because like I said, you saw in that second round series, as clear as day, Denver ain't going anywhere.
No.
And they were not good enough to hang with Denver. And Denver's probably only going to get better, really, from here, frankly, you would think, as these guys continue to play together over time. So I think that's the real challenge. And that's no disrespect to Frank Vogel, but Monty Williams is a good coach too. Like, to me, it's about what are they going to do with this roster this summer? And that's going to be one of the more challenging situations going forward in the league, I think, to figure out how they can add enough to that group to get it where it needs to be Denver
well,
in the West.
Well, and I got to tell you, we've been talking about the big choices coming for Portland, about what they do with the number three pick and Dame Lillard and how that's going to really affect the league. The Chris Paul situation is a prickly one. He is guaranteed out of what's the number?
It's 15.8 million out of 30.8. He's guaranteed 15.8.
And that includes the second year too. He's got 15 guaranteed left total over the final 2 years of the deal.
Right. And I might be off a day or two, but it's a late June.
I could tell you right now. I'll pull it up right
now. June 29th. That might be a day or two off.
June 28th. Sorry.
I think we can all agree that Chris Paul is not a $30 million player anymore. Okay. The problem is if you pick up the option and keep him for $30 million because he is your point guard, now you're headed into that situation where you're going to lose the ability to do certain things under the new rules. Mm-hmm. If you let him go, then you don't have an asset to really to trade, which, you know, in theory, even though they're out all these first round picks, Chris Paul does have value out in the market. There could be some interest in him.
Sure.
And even if you wanted to trade him before the pickup, the guaranteed date, he only counts as much money as his guarantee is. That's the rules, NBA rules. So you can't trade him for like a star player, however you would do that. So
you're almost better off guaranteeing his salary and using him as an expiring deal to bring in, like you said, McMahon, even if you get just two or three players for him, I would almost rather have depth, like okay depth, and save some other team money than have one Chris Paul at $30 million at 38 with his health issues on top of everything else.
Look at what happened with Westbrook. You know, the Lakers had to sweeten that deal with a pick, but I think Chris Paul, you know, might have more interest in the league. There might be some more interest in him than Westbrook for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, that's what the Lakers did. The Lakers, at the end of the day, used Westbrook as an expiring contract, and the Jazz, you know, cleared their books off with him.
Yeah. I'll say that, like, giving him $15.8 million to not play for you next year and having nothing to show for it, to me, is just that's not an option a championship contending team can take.
Not when you have very few other ways to improve your roster. It'd be one thing if they had a bunch of picks and other, you know, space or whatever. Yeah. But I mean, there is a way that they could wave and stretch him and the cap hit would go down, but it's still got the same
problem. But you're not creating cap flexibility.
That's right. Because
the only way if you went that route, you'd have to, if you waived and stretch him and stretch the 15 over 5 years, then you'd have to try to send DeAndre Ayton to some cap space team for basically nothing. And then you're talking about having enough room to maybe go do something. But that's a lot of gymnastics to then maybe get a player. And then you're still in the same position where you have three guys and then you have literally no depth. And I just don't know if that's going to be good enough to get where they want to go at this point.
And the Suns don't need another star.
Right.
They have, like, listen, they've got two guys who can combine to score 70 or 80 points any given night. They've got two of the best offensive players in basketball. They need to fill out the supporting cast. They
need reliable depth. Power.
Yes.
Reliable depth is what they need.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by. So you mentioned Monty Williams. Detroit makes a pretty interesting hire with him, gives him the largest contract in the history of the NBA in terms of coaches, almost $80 million guaranteed over 6 years. Okay, let me just say two things about this. One, for a team in Detroit that needs a culture reset, that has kind of, nothing against Dwayne Casey, but has kind of been aimless at sea for a decade here.
Well, it's a lot like the situation he walked into in Phoenix a few years ago.
Exactly.
Very similar.
I don't think you could have made many better hires than Monty Williams absolutely is a culture setter. I don't know what else he can do, but he absolutely will set a culture there. And I can totally get why the Pistons organization wanted him and everything like that. He didn't want this job.
No, they money whipped.
Okay. And he basically, they offered him so much money that he went, because the word in the NBA was that Monty was taking a year off.
Yeah,
they bought him out of taking a break. He was going to take a break, and they bought him out of doing
it. Everybody in the league was saying that. I mean, the Suns were planning on paying him next year. All these other teams knew it. Monty was going to take care of his family and be with his family and take the year off. Mm-hmm. And it got to be so much money that the taking care of your family inversed. Because it was like, well, wait a minute. I want to do what's best for my family here, but maybe what's best for my family is taking this freaking amazing offer.
How about Matt Ishbia firing a coach with 3 years and $21 million left on his contract and ended up saving money?
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's the NBA. But I'm just worried about the foundation when the guy didn't want the job. He basically bought him.
I hear what you're saying. I just don't think it's in Monty Williams' character to not be fully invested once he commits to doing the job. I
would generally agree with you.
I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is the roster is not very good, and these guys were banking on getting Victor Wembanyama or maybe Scoot Henderson or maybe Brandon Miller, and instead they got the fifth pick in the draft, and there's just a lot of ifs, ands, or buts. Like, Jaden Ivey's a really interesting young guy. Cade Cunningham, I think, I'm really a big fan of him. He obviously had dealt with stress reaction issues last year. Hopefully, like Bradley Beal dealt with those early in his career, he came back and had no issues. Mm-hmm. Here's hoping that Cade Cunningham is on the court next year, because I really like the combination of him and Ivy going forward. But it's a quirky roster, and they haven't had success, and it's going to be a real build, I think, in Detroit. But I'm with you, Brian, from the standpoint that I think that you couldn't have done much better than Monty walking into this job in the summer. And I'm with you, McMahon, from the standpoint that I certainly think while Monty was going to take a break, it seems very obvious, and now he is not for obvious reasons. I think he's going to jump into this thing full bore now that he's doing it.
I would say that it is a roster that has a lot of high-end young talent in need of direction and development. And obviously they felt like Monty Williams was the guy to provide that direction and that development. But, you know, Cade Cunningham, I'm not sure if he's got superstar potential. He certainly has all-star potential. You know, Jaden Ivey was a top five pick for a reason.
Jalen Duren had a really nice year.
Yeah, Jalen Duren, I think, is one of the more promising young big men in the league. They do have a weird thing where they've got all these lottery big guys, but he's the one who I think is really got a chance.
You haven't even mentioned Bagley yet. Do they sign you an extension?
Right. Well, they have the fifth pick.
Wiseman or
Wiseman. My God, Wiseman. Jeez, oh man. Oh my God. I forgot about Wiseman.
Yeah. They have a weird roster, but they also do have the fifth pick this year. Again, they're probably going to get another interesting young player. Like, they do have cap space. Like, they've got a lot of ability to go in a lot of different directions, but they needed to, like you said, I think aimless is a good word to describe Detroit. They've been all over the place from a roster standpoint. They've sort of, you know, taken a bunch of different chances on different guys, got Bagley, got Wiseman. They have these other young guys they've drafted. They go trade for Bojan Bogdanović last year. They thought they were going to take a step forward. Then Kay didn't play. It's just sort of been all over the place, and it will be interesting to see what happens.
They're trying
now.
To buy their way out of their aimlessness is what they're trying to do. Yeah. And maybe it works.
They certainly did. Yeah. I mean, look, Monty Williams, like you said, you look at what he walked into a situation in Phoenix where that was a rudderless, aimless organization, and had a young, intriguing young player in Devin Booker who hadn't been part of winning yet. A few years later, Devin Booker seen as one of the elite players in the league and has grown into a guy that's, I think everybody would agree, is a franchise caliber cornerstone player. And if he could do the same thing with Cade Cunningham, Detroit will be in very good shape.
It really is pretty similar situation, though, because, you know, they had Booker, Bridges, and Ayton. You know, this is a team that's got three young players who have a chance to be, you know, really, really good. It's Monty's job to help them get there.
Yep.
All right, before we go, the NBA Finals.
Oh, wait. Yes. That's why we're in Denver.
That's right. So my viewpoint on watching that game is that, of course, Jokic is brilliant and remains brilliant and is having one of the great postseasons in the NBA history. And I don't know if I've ever seen a player who is more challenging to stop, because while you see guys like LeBron who has the ability to do so much, Jokic's bailout at the end when everything else goes to pot is that he's 7 foot. He can shoot the ball straight up in the air and he can shoot it at 63%. So many times the Heat, not so many, but a number of times the Heat, I thought, had good defensive possessions. And with 3 seconds on the clock, either he made a shot or made a pass and broke them. From the Heat's perspective, and I've been saying this today on TV, I know that they know that Aaron Gordon, Michael Porter Jr., and Jokic are tall. It's not like, I'm not trying to make it sound like they weren't aware of the opposition. But when you go out there and face it, I used to think about this when I saw the Thunder play, when the Thunder were at their prime, you'd see teams go play them. And the first quarter, there'd be like 7 deflections because they can't calculate how long the arms of Russell Westbrook, Serge Ibaka, Kevin Durant, they just couldn't do it until they actually saw it. It was like the Heat, like, oh my God, they are like really big. And I think as soon as Michael Malone saw that lineup came in, that had Caleb Martin still in there, he's like, okay, we're unleashing the big boys. And Gordon ate up Strus and Martin and Jimmy Butler, no matter what you want to say. Yeah. I think they should probably show Jimmy in the film room today, the film of him jawing at Jrue Holiday, because Jimmy was I'm very cautious saying the word intimidated, because Jimmy is intimidated by anything, but Jimmy didn't want any business in those big boys.
Hey, I mean,
he did not drive.
What's crazy, the fact that he took 2 free throws in the game, and it's not like a controversy, like why weren't they getting whistles? They did not attack the paint. They just did not attack the paint with what's Jokic's one major flaw. He's not a good rim protector. I saw, I think our stats and info folks had something where he only defended 2 shots at the rim in the entire game. They just weren't attacking the paint. And for Jimmy to have it's one thing for Jimmy to have the kind of game where he's struggling to finish. For him to have a game where he was that unaggressive was shocking. And listen, they just came off, obviously, an incredibly grueling 7-game series. I don't know, maybe they can refuel with a couple days between games. They look like a team that was running on fumes.
Well, look, they were not as good talent-wise as the Milwaukee Bucks. They were not as good talent-wise as the Boston Celtics. Why did they win those series? Because Jimmy Butler was the best player on the court in those games, and because they were much more poised and much more disciplined, particularly late in those games. The reason I was not confident in this being much of a competitive series, and I think we saw it in game one, those advantages are gone in this series. Nikola Jokic is in total control of the game when he has the ball, and Denver is not going to have these moments like the Celtics did throughout that series against Miami, where they will just fall apart for 6 or 8 or 12 minutes.
Yeah. It's harder to win when the other team doesn't hand you the ball as much as the Celtics.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a crazy basic analysis to use when we're talking about teams in the conference finals and finals, but the Celtics controlled most of game one. They controlled most of game two, and then they would implode in key moments and Jimmy would be there to take advantage of it. Jokic is just not going to do that. And I thought Denver was fine in game one. I didn't think they played great. It was like a B game, I would say. I mean, yeah. They played well.
They only scored 104 points. I mean, I know the pace of the game wasn't down, but 104 points.
They kind of took their foot off the gas in the fourth quarter.
If you say so, they had their starters in. I mean,
I know.
What I'm saying is, I think the Nuggets can play a lot better.
Oh, yeah.
They definitely can.
Michael Porter Jr. Can definitely shoot better than 2 of 11, but he contributed in a lot of ways, but. You know, Joker was like shocked when he looked at the box score, and somebody said, "You know, what were you shocked by?" He goes, "I can't believe Michael was 2 of 11 from three. I swore he hit like 6 or 7 because he was getting those kind of looks."
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, Brian, the size. I thought Denver had a brilliant game plan. If this series is not played in transition, because there's basically no transition either way, Miami has no chance of scoring with Denver over the course of 7 games. I don't think like they have to get easy baskets. They have to get out and run. Denver just getting the ball to Aaron Gordon inside, just bucket after bucket in the first quarter. What?
Wendy, do you remember when Bontemps said that the Nuggets couldn't win a championship with Joker as the defensive anchor? I don't know.
A lot of people said a lot of things about Denver.
What has happened to our good friend, Mr. Bontemps?
Well, but it's not about to Brian's point though. Jokic has, I said going into the playoffs, he had more pressure on than any player in the league because there were no excuses, and he's delivered on every level. He's been incredible. He's now undisputedly, in my opinion, the best player in the world, and they're going to win the title probably in a week or so, barring something crazy happening. But I say that about playing a slow game. It's not about Denver's defense. Miami's offense can't keep up with Denver. Like they played a mediocre offensive game, scored 105 points, and Miami scored 80 because if Miami's not getting easy buckets, they're not going to win. And like Bam Adebayo, the most aggressive game of his life in that game. And, you know, he had 26 on 25 shots. If he's taking 25 shots, that's a huge win for Denver, I think.
Especially if they're mid-range jump shots.
I know. I wrote a piece about this that's going to publish on Saturday. Bam Adebayo actually has a very impressive resume in games against the Nuggets in his career. They played earlier this year. The last time they played in Denver, he had like 22 points, 7 rebounds, 4 steals, 2 blocks. He's had a bunch of those types of games. Last year when they played in Denver, he had a triple double. Here he has 26 and 13. And like every single time, Jokic just outplays him. Just like, seriously, you go back and look at the string of games. It's like, oh, in this game, Bama had 24, 13, and 8. That's awesome. What did Jokic have? Oh, he had 28, 15, and 12. Oh, okay. And now Jokic is 11-2 against Bam. And I'm not even like looking at Bam like, oh man, you're getting worked. Like, and you're right, Bontemps, like 26 points and 25 shots is not what they're looking for. But Bam played his best game in weeks.
Yeah.
And the Heat were undefeated.
You know what?
He were undefeated.
You know what the Nuggets love? 27 points on 12 shots by Joker, more assists than shots. The guy absolutely dominated the first quarter and he attempted one shot in the final minute.
And in the final minute,
it was a layup with 3 seconds to go in the quarter.
Yeah.
And it was off like a loose ball. Like the ball kind of came and landed in his lap.
He had six assists. Every one of the other starters was assisted by Jokic at least once before he even attempted a shot. He dominated the first half.
One of the things that
3 for 3 from the floor and absolutely dominated the first half.
It's easier said than done. They have to try to make him a scorer. If they allow him to just operate out of the post and just hit guys for shots, that's how he wants to play. He would much rather have 3 shots and have 10 points and 10 assists than have 25 points and 2 assists at halftime. He doesn't want to play like that.
And that was their game plan. But then they saw how freaking big that they were, and they couldn't. Look, they just didn't calculate that Aaron Gordon was going to put Strus and Caleb Martin into the basket standard. Maybe they should have.
They had no chance against that.
Maybe they should have, but they didn't compute it.
And Joker is obviously one of the best passers ever to play the game. Not just the best passing big man, one of the best passers to ever play the game at any position. But
for sure,
who's better? Is Magic? Are we talking? Is it him and Magic? Yeah.
We can talk about Magic. We can talk about
Jason Kidd.
I mean, I think John Stockton does have like 18 million assists.
Right.
We're probably going to
Steve Nash.
I mean, but yeah, we're talking about the best passers of all time. It's a very short list. I'll say this though, the guys that Joker plays with, they absolutely enhance his incredible passing ability. Obviously, the two-man game with Jamal Murray is just spectacular. I mean, the dribble handoff stuff, everything they do off of that. Porter's ability to move without the ball. He's learned how to cut, not just move for threes. KCP, just a perfect fit. Gordon is Bruce one of the Brown. Best cutters in the league. Bruce Brown. I mean, these guys all understand, hey, everything is going through Joker, but he doesn't want to dominate the ball. He wants to get us, you know, these great looks. If we're moving, if we're cutting, if we're on the same page with him, it's going to be dunks. It's going to be layups. It's going to be open threes. And they all are so good at playing off of him.
I thought Alan Hahn on Get Up today had an amazing line. He was talking about how the Jokic kind of throws guys open,
mm-hmm.
kind of like a quarterback can throw guys open. He'll throw a pass to a spot. And even if the guy's not open, the guy knows where to go.
Yep.
He said that Jokic and Pat Mahomes or Patrick Mahomes are a lot alike. They both wear number 15 and they dominate Denver, or they own Denver, I think is what he said. But that's true, man. He throws guys open. It's crazy. It's amazing.
They both throw from every different angle. Right?
That's exactly right. I thought it was an amazing comparison. Normally I think Allen's off his rocker. On this one, I give him 5 stars.
Well, and it's so reminiscent to me of Golden State, and obviously they got to still win a couple more games, but I think we could be seeing the beginning of a run like that, especially with these new rules and the fact they have this team in place.
Yeah,
and it's so like, I don't remember if it was you, I think you referenced it on your pod with Zach, Brian, when you would see teams go up against Golden State in the playoffs, you know, or as Cleveland or anybody else, the first game or two, they would be like, oh man, like, and they'd have to like readjust to playing against the Warriors and the way they play being so much different than everybody mm-hmm. else. And like you said, you go into this game and you could talk about, yeah, Aaron Gordon 6'10 and Michael Porter 6'10. And we got to do the two-man game with Jamal and Jokic. And we got to watch for Bruce Brown cutting. And we got to watch for KCP spotting up for threes. But then the game starts and you feel it. And then you have to recalibrate everything you're doing because they just don't play like anybody else. And mm-hmm. it's what makes them so fun to watch. And it's what makes them so difficult to guard. Cause like you said, you just watch these games and Jamal and Jokic aren't saying anything. And they just like, oh yeah, I'm going to run over here and do this and do that. And if they just sort of symbiotically know where to be. And then you figure it's just impossible to stop.
Yeah. Then you figure out how to, okay, here's how we're going to stop this two-man game. Oh, because you did that, there's a wide open three for Michael Porter Jr. Whoops, Aaron Gordon just cut to the basket, and you know his guy's helping, and that's a dunk for him.
Yeah, I would say it's hard. It's almost impossible to stop Jokic if Jamal Murray is on. You know, he hit 8 of 12 in the first half.
Yeah,
it's curtains. All right, that's why it's too long.
That's why they're down 20. Well, real quick, because we sort of just said that there's no chance for Miami. Do we think they should? No. Are there any things we should ask that they should try to do? I would say they should play Kevin Love over Chambers. Cody Zeller. Well, that might help. I would try Kevin Love over Cody Zeller. The Cody Zeller minutes were a disaster. I would try to just space the floor a little bit, see if Kevin could hit some shots. I'd consider maybe trying to start Kevin and just have some more size out there. Maybe have him guard Jokic and just have Bam as a helper. And just so, because they're so small when they've got Strus and Cody Martin.
If you take Bam off and you make Bam a sort of like a little bit of a rover, you can sort of leave Aaron Gordon. You roll the dice on Aaron. I mean, you know, if he beats you, he beats you. The Heat, you know, Max Strus was 0 of 9 on threes. If Max Strus goes 3 of 9, okay, that's 9 more points, which was the difference in the, well, you know, math. And that's three times where they can, that's 3 times where they can get back on defense. So I think the Heat, when look at this now, they wouldn't say that they played good defense. They thought that they were completely disorganized from their game plan. So I don't want to make it sound like they played good defense, but the scoring that they allowed was a win, and it was in winnable, in the winnable zone. You know, 104 points. I think they had 112 offensive efficiency, considering this team is the number one offensive team in the playoffs.
Yeah, you said last night before the game, if you'd said Bam scored 26 and the Nuggets scored 104, you would think that Miami won the game.
So Listen. Look, and you guys know, I think it's dangerous to overreact to game one. Mm-hmm. But when I speak about what I'm seeing, what everybody's seeing, I'm not just talking about the Heat winning. I'm talking about winning 4 out of 6. So that's really the challenge.
You're talking about a team losing 4 times. It's only lost 3 games through 3+ playoff series. I mean, they're an absolute machine. Yeah. Jimmy Butler has to put his cape on. Period.
End of the podcast. Thank you very much. We'll come back to you next week. Sorry.
Adios, amigos.
My schedule is my schedule. I'm so sorry.
Here we go. Hey, too much work.
Did you guys know how important Wendy is? Adios, amigos. Well, thanks for squeezing me in for dinner.
I haven't even set it up yet. Thank you to Mark Lazary, former owner of Milwaukee Bucks, for joining us. Thank you to Jackson, our producer. Thank you to Tim McMahon and Tim Bontemps. And thank you for listening to the pod. We will be back with you before game 3 with another special guest. Who will it be? Let's wait and find out.
Gracias por todo y adios, amigos.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.